Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you could change one thing to transform the American classroom, what would it be? I mean, I'm talking really transformational change here. What would that classroom look like? What would those kids be learning? How would they be learning it? And most importantly, why would they be learning it? Well, Ted Dinter-Smith has an answer. He's a former venture capitalist with a keen interest in education, and he recently went about doing his own kind of experiential learning when it comes to the future of American education. For the entire 2015-2016 school year, he traveled to each and every state, visited some 200 schools, met with everyone from students and teachers to school boards, legislators, and governors, and he compiled what he learned into the new book, What School Could Be, Insights and Inspiration from Teachers Across America. And Ted Dinter-Smith joins us today from New York. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Ted.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I am a very learn-by-example kind of person, so I would like to start off with a specific example that you bring up in the book about a classroom that, in your mind, really describes what school could be like. It's in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and it's the classroom of Jared Nipper, a kindergarten teacher. What's so special about what he's doing?
Well, Jared, you have to visualize. I meet him at a community forum, and he stands up, and he's about 6'2", 300 pounds. He looks like an offensive lineman for the Indianapolis Colts. And I thought this guy was going to just say, you know, go away. You know, I don't believe anything you're saying. And he goes into this great story about taking over a kindergarten class, his first chance to teach, and connecting these kids to challenges like designing robots and doing 3D printing. And it was just such a telling story. And I'd include at the very top of the list, he didn't know anything about those topics at the start. Took these kids out to Fort Wayne. They raised money from the community to get the equipment. And then they just learned together about it. And I tracked him during the school year. Those kids were on fire. It was just inspiring story from an unlikely place.
Well, you say that he wanted his class to be all about making things, and because he has an interesting background too, right? Former police officer and a coach as well. And how did this all come together to make a class? I mean, kindergartners designing prostheses is pretty cool, but they're still kindergartners though, right?
Very, and these kids can do it. I mean, I think that's what I heard over and over again in all sorts of settings, is that if you trust the teacher, and Jared had a principal that trusted him, and you let these kids go on challenges they care about, that's when the magic happens. You know, but Jared, in his police role, had been kind of almost like a on-site security guy for one of the schools. And he said, oh my gosh, these kids, by the time they get to high school, kids he was coaching, they seem to have lost their curiosity and got really passionate about the idea of teaching, got his teaching credential, got a chance to teach. I stay in close contact with him. He's now principal of an elementary school. So he's really making huge strides in Fort Wayne.
Wow. Okay. So how then, keeping Jared Nipper's kindergarten classroom as our example, how then does that differ from what we would typically think is the kind of learning that goes on in American classrooms?
Well, I would contrast Jared, what he did, with what Jared was told to do by the state of Indiana. And what he said to me, half joking but quite seriously, is that when he got his marching orders, it called for having these kids do 90-minute uninterrupted blocks of reading time. And he laughed. He said to me, do the people who make these things up ever spend time with a 5-year-old? My kids don't want to sit in a desk for 90 straight minutes. And so he thought carefully about what types of challenges would appeal to this particular set of kids that would get them motivated to learn to read and learn basic math skills, but in the context of something they thought was really cool. And his principal backed him up. He said, you'll have some detractors, and he did. But he kind of won everybody over. And he's one of many, but I met these teachers all over the country that had that same mindset about leading with engaging their kids and having the support and trust of people around them.
Okay. So Ted, it's really interesting because you talk about in your book how in your view, there are a lot of things holding back American education from where it needs to be for the 21st century. And we'll get into some more of those, a couple more of those things a little later in this conversation. But you also discuss that it's still aspects of it are kind of frozen in time, that we've been doing teaching and learning I don't want to draw such a broad brush, say like every classroom is like this, because of course it's not. You visited 200 schools. That's evidence in and of itself. But that overall, the way we think about education probably hasn't evolved as much as it should have in the past century or so. And this is actually an issue that we've talked about on Radio Boston a lot, because I'm kind of obsessed with it. And it came up surprisingly in a conversation that I had with Joy Ito last year. Mm-hmm. He's the head of the MIT Media Lab, right? And he wrote this book called Whiplash, about how societies can cope with what the future and technology is going to bring. And his co-author, Jeff Howe, who's at Northeastern, talked to me about why American education really sort of lags in terms of what's needed for the 21st century. And he talked about Horace Mann. So I just want you to listen to this, Ted.
Horace Mann comes in the 19th century and reforms American education to make it compulsory, so everyone's going, but to make people who could then go out and act like a widget. And this was a philanthropic urge. Like, he wanted people to be able to survive and be employed. The problem now is that if Horace Mann were alive, he'd be like, hey, dummies, drop it. Like, it's the opposite. If people are going to act like machines, our machines got really good. Like, it's the one way they'll never be employed. So they have to become good at stuff that machines can't do. Meanwhile, our educational system is teaching them to do things that machines can do. It's crazy. Yeah.
Do you think it's crazy, Ted?
Well, I agree with the quote. Joey's an interesting example. A college dropout. He did this experiment with one of his MIT students where he wired her up with an EEG and tracked her during the week. And you see these periods where it's at a dead stop, zeroed out level for periods of time. You think that's when she's sleeping. That's when she's in a lecture hall.
What? An MIT student?
Yeah, for a week. And you can Google his blog and that has it. Or my book I wrote with Tony Wagner has that as well. So I agree, but I also disagree.
Okay.
You know, it's sort of an established, entrenched model. It's not something you find just in bad schools. I mean, I've been to most of the top expensive private schools in Boston. You can find an awful lot of teachers talking at students, students taking notes, cramming for recall-based exams. And the point I make is, if a student today in America is really good at content memorization, replicating low-level procedures, formulaic writing, and following instructions, they can generally be, if not valedictorian, in the top 10 of their class. And those are exactly the skills and competencies of machine intelligence. But, and what I found as I traveled and what I write about and celebrate is, first, great things are happening everywhere.
Right.
There are some really remarkable examples of innovation in any community. And the second thing is, don't blame the teachers for this. They are being held accountable to low-level standardized tests. And when you are held accountable to certain metrics, you are getting up every morning having to make a choice between doing what will look better on the test or what's better for the child.
So what did teachers then in the 200 places that you visit, what did they tell you that they need?
Trust.
From?
From parents, from their principal, from other teachers. You know, I visited Emporia, Kansas. It's the National Teachers Hall of Fame. They have this knoll with a little chapel, and they have all these tombstones up with teachers that have given their lives for students. And in the book, I make the observation, we trust teachers with the lives of our students, but we don't trust them with their lesson plans. It doesn't make any sense. And so these teachers have entered the profession to engage and inspire kids, yet we micromanage their curriculum and determine whether they're a good teacher or not based on MCAS scores in Massachusetts. And you go and I always tell adults, look at the questions on, you know, some sample online questions from these tests, mm-hmm. and ask, are these important things to you as an adult later in life? And they really, you know, you look at it, I say it's one hop over from crossword puzzles and Sudoku.
Well, so since you took us there to accountability and to testing, let me just ask you, I mean, the pushback to what you're saying is, for example, I mean, let's talk about MCAS. There are a lot of people, and I think this is a very persuasive argument, who would say that since 1993, when Massachusetts passed its education reform and said MCAS is going to be a measure by which how much schools are achieving or doing right by their students, that it is one of the reasons why the state, on average, as a whole, performs really well. It's one of the best performing states in the country. And, you know, Massachusetts educators like to say perhaps in the world. So, you know, isn't there some use for testing, for assessments in order to see how far students have come or have yet to go?
I think we owe it to any child that they develop learning how to learn skills. You know, can they read? Can they Can they write effectively? Do they have basic math skills? You know, those are important mm-hmm. things. And I think standardized tests used thoughtfully and diagnostically can play a role in that. But we do kind of the opposite, which is we amp up the stakes on these tests in the higher grades. During the period of time, kids should be developing distinctive capabilities and the types of things that are very hard to test, you know, creativity, boldness, thinking, you know, outside the box, all collaboration, all the things that really matter to adults in the workplace today, those are things you can't standardize test. They are what people, I think, pejoratively refer to as soft skills. They're not soft. There's nothing soft about them. They're hard to develop and hard to be excellent at. But those are the things that should be amplified in the higher grades. And I think that they largely lose out in the crush for take AP, you know, great example. A lot of people think that's a pinnacle of education. Yet when I interview most students about what they learned in their AP course, it's often, I learned I never want to take this subject
right.
again.
I mean, or I learned how to get a 5 on the AP exam.
Yeah. Exactly. Or, and you go to any bookstore and you'll see shelves of AP flashcards. And you know, what's interesting, I mean, the testing organizations argue that they're trying to get at more nuanced skills. But it's very difficult to grade those. You know, if it can be graded by a computer, it can be done by a computer. And so if you're looking for distinctive voice and writing, that's a very difficult thing to find the right caliber of person to be able to evaluate an essay. Mm. And so that generally gets pushed to the side in the standardized test march.
Yeah. So I want to go back to another example that you bring up in the book. This is in Fargo, North Dakota, at Ben Franklin Middle School, their eighth grade history class. Because I think maybe some people might think that this innovative sort of project-based approach that you seem to be advocating, maybe that's in the world of the science and the math classes. But their history class in Fargo was doing something interesting. What did they do there?
They were given the leeway, and it was sort of invented by the students and teachers in conjunction, again, supported by principal and superintendent of that district. And I'm in Fargo a lot, so I know these guys quite well. They asked these kids, what is some aspect of your community's history you'd love to capture? And they noodle, and they say there's some really interesting buildings in downtown Fargo. So small student teams picked buildings, did the research, then the idea just picked up steam. Could we do a photo collage? Could we turn it into a mini documentary? Could we do signs for the building with a QR code that then goes to the video? And they then subsequently turned all this into something longer, submitted it to the Fargo Film Festival. So it's got a little bit of technology, but it's mostly history. So that's a great blending. But it's also teaching these kids to think like historians. You know, instead of memorizing facts, which I think we do too much of in many history classes, they have to think like a historian would think about approaching and capturing and relating to other people the history of, you know, the local mill in, you know, on Main Street. Or, you know, they each sort of in their own way come up with a distinctive approach for telling the story of that building.
Yeah. So it seems as if in the book you sort of summarize a set of characteristics in all of these places that you say are working. And again, to just buttress a point you made earlier, there's no sort of one size fits all here that you're advocating for. It's not like whatever they're doing in Fargo, you're saying they should just pick that up and, you know, drop it in, I don't know, Lawrence, Massachusetts necessarily. But you do say in the book that you find that there were these commonalities in the environments where you saw students thrive. Purpose, essentials, where students are acquiring the skill sets and mindsets needed in an increasingly innovative world. Agency, where students are owning their own learning. And knowledge, where student learning is deep and retained, as you were talking about earlier. So PEAK is the acronym that you created out of that. Given the current challenges of in education, how is it that teachers, principals, school districts can better incorporate these four attributes into day-to-day learning?
Yeah. One of the challenges in the book, I mean, no two of these experiences were the same. And I actually don't advocate. I'm doing my best to tell the story of the teachers and showing what happens when teachers are trusted. So I'm really amplifying their stories instead of saying everybody needs to do X, because there is an awful lot in our world of former business guys, particularly tech business guys, deciding they can tell everybody what they need to do. And I try to be the opposite of that. I try to support, you know, almost be like the blocking back on a football team, clearing the way for teachers to do what they're passionate to do.
Okay, but just let me jump in here, Ted. Just to be clear, because I did introduce you as a former venture capitalist, right? You're a partner emeritus at Charles River Ventures. And look, you hit on something that's really important with Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, all other sort of nameless billionaires out there who all of a sudden have become really passionate about reforming American education. Did you meet some pushback from folks when you went around the country? Because I imagine a lot of teachers just looked at you and said, oh, here comes another one.
Teachers, I mean, I would, when I meet teachers, particularly when I talk to groups, I always preface it. I start by saying, I know how you feel when somebody's introduced as a former business person interested in education. And if you're saying to yourself, here we go again, I feel your pain, I understand, and I'm trying to make up for this. Because a lot of those initiatives have not made any sense. They've been anywhere from unproductive to counterproductive. But I think what's interesting is I've actually done my homework. You know, I haven't just done a few photo ops. I mean, I've been out there traveling relentlessly, meeting, hearing, listening to, trying to understand. And I do have a lens of what's going to lead to kids that could actually do well in a world of innovation. You know, because I've seen it. I've worked with a bunch of younger people, and I know what kinds of backgrounds I think we're going to help them, and I know which ones will be counterproductive. Yeah. And so I think there's this really interesting combination, and I think there's a fair amount of, I'd say as I travel and I talk about something as simple as aligning school with life, mm-hmm. you know, nobody really says that makes no sense. And right. so I don't get pushback on some of the fundamentals, but I think a lot of business people, if you just talk to them, will think, you know, it's the teachers or it's the teacher unions or it's the monopoly of the locals. There are a bunch of problem type of formulaic things that some people will say without ever really stopping to look, dig in, meet with people and have any kind of perspective on it. And I think you'll see teachers as well. Some will just say, you have never been a classroom teacher, kind of shut up and go away. I think if we're going to really make our schools great, there needs to be two-way discussion there. And I think business people have a lot they can do to support and help our schools. And I think teachers, I'm a big fan of teachers shadowing students and out in the workplace. And so if you had an English teacher with some students sitting in and watching your show, they find that really interesting. And teachers, I think, actually are quite curious about what happens out, you know, in the professional environment when you're outside of school. Right. So I think there's a lot to be learned from each other.
So Ted, I have to ask you, because you mentioned that aligning school with life, and you write exactly those words in a chapter in the book about social equity. And first of all, I just want to ask you, I mean, again, to get back to testing for a second, there are lots of folks who say testing is the window by which that gives us a view in terms of about how we might go about, or if we are adequately going about, closing achievement gaps. And so you say that this raises a profound question. If we align school with life, could we elevate learning for all kids while closing an authentic achievement gap? Did you see a school in the 200 that you visited that was doing this measurably?
Absolutely. Okay. You know, so the point I make is, I met thousands and thousands of kids. Not one is interested in test prep. Not one. And so if you make school largely around test prep, you know, cram for the SAT, you know, memorize flashcards, you're not reflecting the child's interest, talents, and potential. You're reflecting how much the parents are pushing the kid. And I think that's why the rich families do better on that stuff than the poor families. I go to a lot of schools. I was just this morning at a school in the Bronx where these kids actually are doing really well on their test scores, but the school had nothing to do with test prep. I mean, these kids are composing music, writing the lyric, you know, hip-hop, 3D printing, designing, you know. They said, why don't we start with what the kids are really interested in? If the kids can't wait to get to school, this is a public school in the Bronx, they will learn. And I think what we've done is we've inverted that. We've said, somehow we've convinced ourselves that if a kid memorizes obstreperous and could factor polynomials and test well with that we've done that kid a favor.
I got so
and
so
I
so
the, I'm just, the opposite.
Let me jump in here. So for the example that you just gave about the school in the Bronx, the tests were still there, but the learning was not geared at all to the tests. And in fact, because of that, they were learning more and performing better on the tests.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
And you know, you saw it in the film. I did this film with great director Greg Whiteley.
Yeah, most likely to succeed. Right.
Yeah. And those kids do just fine on the tests, but they're not doing any test prep in the school. And so But it's very difficult. It's easy for me to say here from a studio or writing a book to your kids will do just fine. But when those test results are published in the newspaper, the magazine, when your school is rated by those test scores, boom, it's very difficult to say, let's just focus on stuff the kids love to learn and trust the fact or hope for the fact that the test scores will be fine. Right. So we send this message to the teachers that you're going to be evaluated on the basis of this, I think, largely obsolete set of metrics. But then we can't really just say, and don't pay that much attention to it.
We just got a minute or two here to go, Ted. So my last question is, I want to come back to something you said earlier, that the number one thing teachers tell you that they need to succeed more for their students in the classroom is trust. So that means trust from school committees, trust from district level leaders. And I would say that, is it also true that those district level leaders who want to bring about change need trust from legislators, from governors, from, you know, the Department of Education? And if so, how are we going to change that dynamic? Because it sounds like you're asking almost everyone in the educational chain to give up a little control here.
Or give up a lot of control.
Or
but
a lot.
I write about New Hampshire. So neighbor to the north, New Hampshire, which from, you know, the years 2002 to 2008 had an incredible transformation of education. They trusted the teachers to put in place, develop a next generation form of accountability, which they did based on tangible evidence of student work. And the standards were actually really high, but they trusted the teachers to lead the way with that. And so it was performance-based, competency-based. And the quality of work in that the students are doing is much higher than it is in neighboring states. And I'll tell you this, when I visit, and I've been to a lot of schools in New Hampshire, those kids ask better questions by a lot than a lot of the adults in states I went to.
Wow. Well, the new book is called What School Could Be: Insights and Inspiration from Teachers Across America. It's by Ted Dinser-Smith. He's also producer of a 2015 movie called Most Likely to Succeed. Ted Dinser-Smith, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you, and love your show.
Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, and we had help today from Zoe Mitchell, Amy Pollard, Cassandra Sunt, and Lily Tyson. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And by the way, if you want some links to all the other education conversations we've had, go to our website, radioboston.org. This is Radio Boston.